Greetings. Greetings once again. That's right, it's the Weekly Worldview, and I'm your host, Doug McBurney. Welcome back. It's the show where we don't take calls, we don't tolerate sponsors, but we do help focus you on the events of the week through the lens, even. Can't even do my intro anymore. I'm getting old, I tell you. It's original thought and all that, you probably know. Anyway, pay attention, because by the time you listen to this, chances are the die will have been cast regarding Anthony Fauci, the evil, despicable, deplorable Anthony Fauci. That's right. Monday, May 11th, the 5-year statute of limitations runs out. And if he's not indicted for lying to the leftist establishment that organized and executed his despicable campaign of lies and fear-mongering and tyranny that destroyed the country for almost 3 years, he will have the green light that he's gotten away with it, and everyone in the leftist establishment will have gotten the green light that they can try it all again, and there will be nothing to restrain their next evil plot. And I'm not a conspiracy theorist. It's just that I lived through that particular conspiracy, and so I am somewhat concerned. Okay. So, from there, should we move right on into the inevitable aliens story? Yeah, that's right. I haven't heard that one in a while. That's right. It's been 3 days since Alex Jones and the rest of the hyperventilators got access to the UFO files. And so far, nothing. I mean, there's some grainy photos or reports of grainy photos of some sort of streaks of light on the Apollo 17 mission, and that's about it. That nothing of any interest. But I know what Alex would say. He would say, but of course, Doug, of course the CIA is going to hide all the real files. And they're going to trick you with this false flag release. Donald Trump's a failure. He's a false flagger. Yeah. See, that's the problem with Alex Jones. Actually, it's not just Alex Jones. It's Alex Jones aficionados as well. And I love you all, by the way. But the thing is you can't really argue with an Alex Jones aficionado, because they just move to the next level of delusion. And then if you refuse to join them, you're no longer qualified for the argument. So I'm not going to argue. You all have fun in the rabbit hole, going through the files and looking at the videos and listening to whatever. All you kids have fun. The adults in the room know that the only extraterrestrial beings in the universe are not humanoids on other planets seeking to make contact with us here on Earth. They're angelic beings, clearly defined in the Bible, and they're not being allowed to intervene on Earth right now by God. So relax. I mean, at least about that. But if you want to have fun poking through the rabbit hole of the UFO release, go right ahead. If you're doing it just for entertainment purposes, well, I've got no problem with that. All right. And then, well, I guess I have to address this. I don't know if this will be a big story or not, but what's been the most disturbing thing about the release of the UFO files? What was the video I saw this morning allegedly showing Lauren Boebert linking aliens with the Nephilim and the fallen angels in the Bible? Have you seen this video, he asked? It's extremely attractive.
I don't follow.
Audio engineer. You don't follow any of that stuff? Well, I saw the video, and I mean, all the aliens and the Nephilim aside, if that's really what Boebert looks like these days, someone needs to call for an intervention. I mean, if she thinks she needs to look that way for whoever it is she's trying to impress or pick up or date, I mean, I don't know her situation. But wow. Man, is divorce embarrassing? I mean, on top of all the other devastation, you know, she's got this, it's like the toxed up, injected, teeth bleached look that seems really popular among the in crowd on the Republican side these days. On top of the devastation and the embarrassment of divorce, you just end up looking like a complete, well, anyway, it's just not worth it, Lauren. Trust me. Whatever you're trying to do, just stop with it. I mean, nobody needs that. Okay. So from the aliens that haven't materialized, at least in my estimation, we go over to Spain to Punta Marina. Punta Marina, it's a seaside town. Not in Spain, I apologize. Italy. Seaside town there in Italy. And it has been taken over, at least according to some residents, by a herd, a flock of somewhere around 400 peacocks. And some of the folks in the town are calling for someone to do something about exterminating the peacocks, while others in the community are defending the birds, saying that they're a source of pride there in the community and all of that. Many residents are lamenting the defecation of the peacocks, among other things. There's the defecation, that's probably the main thing. But then there's the frightening of the children and the damaging of the rooftops and the obstructing of traffic.
And scratching the car.
Yeah, and the attacking of cars. Yeah. Yeah, we had a few peacocks at one time at part of our menagerie here on the McBurney compound, and one of them attacked my brand new car and scratched it beyond all recognition.
Nah, that's a little bit it.
Well, that might be a slight exaggeration, but
it
was pretty shocking to walk out and see my brand new car scratched. I could still recognize it, but it was pretty scratched up, and started researching and found out that peacocks are not really the best idea. That's right. Peacocks often mistake their own reflections for rival birds, and they attack. So if you have a shiny new car, they fight your car. Yeah. The birds, according to some in the community, the birds also scream throughout the night during mating season, prompting some residents to reportedly have to turn to sleep medication. like they weren't already medicated. Anyway, peacocks, to me, they're emblematic of the fall, the fact that we live in a fallen world. How could something that beautiful be so mean and destructive? I remember a peacock attacked my wife, and I was grabbing for a shotgun. I was going to kill the bird, but I was restrained. Okay. Now, it's Mother's Day, and so I could just wish everyone a happy Mother's Day, and I do. I wish everyone a happy's. See, I tell you, getting old, I can barely speak anymore. I'll have to cancel the show pretty soon because I just won't be able to string words together in a coherent fashion, and that'll be the end of it. But happy Mother's Day to everyone out there. And so for Mother's Day, we go to the Mother's Dirge file from MSNBC, which is now called MS.Now. Yeah. There was I went there because, well, frankly, there just wasn't that much news of of any interest to me this week because I'm losing interest in the news as time goes by. Maybe I'm not able to comprehend it anymore. Maybe I'm just grown up and I just don't care that much anymore. Maybe it's because Facebook linked me to one of these shows from, I don't know, 12 years ago, 6 years ago. And I realized that all the stories that seemed really important at the time, I couldn't even remember them. They just weren't that important. But MS.now is always good for not just for an entertaining headline, but a headline that is symptomatic of what's wrong with everything. The link on the MS.now homepage screamed the following: "Moms in America are reaching a breaking point." That's the clickbait link. I clicked it. You get to the headline. The headline is: "The high cost of motherhood leaves many women deciding against it." It's right. It's a story posted on Mother's Day by Kristen Rowe Finkbeiner, who's a reporter at there at MS Now. And she writes, "As Americans celebrate Mother's Day, mothers are facing an unprecedented affordability crisis." Unprecedented affordability crisis? Really? Kristen, how old are you? Have you ever read any history about anything? Unprecedented? Okay, well, unprecedented in her lifetime anyways. She goes on to say that Gen Z and millennial women are delaying parenthood, having fewer children, or like not becoming parents at all. Women want families, but find the costs make parenting like unaffordable, she says. I read through the whole article, and you know what's missing from the story? The word "like" is not missing. It's implied. But what's missing from the story is men, dad, husband. No mention of any of that. The words "husband," "man," "men," or "male" do not appear in the article at all. And the only mention of "father" or "dad" is in the following section: "Moms are paid just 74 cents for every dollar paid to full-time dads." And even worse, black moms are paid just 56 cents. Latina moms, just 51 centavos for every dollar for the full-time non-Hispanic white father. This is part of a deep, enduring wage and hiring discrimination pattern against moms. Women raising children were also offered significantly lower starting salaries, while dads got a wage increase. Okay. So notice how the trained urinalist purposely presents women and dads in opposition to one another on Mother's Day. That's MS Now for you. And that's about all it's worth. It must be delightful to be in the company of Kristen Rowe Finkbeiner on Mother's Day. Can you imagine how delightful it must be around the table celebrating Mother's Day with Kristen? All right. Emblematic. That's right. So I talked about how peacocks are emblematic of the fall of man. MS Now is emblematic of the degeneration of American culture. Kristen Rowe Finkbeiner is emblematic of modern urinalism. All right, it's the Weekly Worldview, and we're back. That's right. There's a girl who can't get no satisfaction. My extremely attractive audio engineer was rather unimpressed with that story.
I'm sorry. But
that's because she's not struggling against the patriarchy. All right. Just imagine. That's right. Asian women. Doesn't say anything about Asian moms here because you guys got it made in the shade. You're not like the poor urinalist there. So I wonder if Kristen has any kids. So I'm sure she has a mom, and her mom must be delighted with her. All right. But now, from Mother's Day, which is a story that will come and go today, we move on to a story that may come and may stick around, although we hope it doesn't, so we check in with CNN for a report on the lethal hantavirus. Lethal. Lethal hantavirus cases are on the rise, they say, in the headline. That's right. Uh-huh. Hantavirus case. I refer back to the fact that Anthony Fauci, he needs to be indicted by Monday, or maybe there's going to be a hantavirus pandemic. Hantavirus cases, according to CNN, in Argentina have doubled. 32 are dead. It's the highest number of infections since 2018, which means they're tracking infections, which that's never a good sign. They go on to say a couple died amid the outbreak. Okay, amid the outbreak, did they die from the outbreak, or was the outbreak just around them and they died of some other causes? I don't know, but they were on the cruise ship that you've all heard about, which is reminiscent of the cruise ships at the beginning of the last pandemic episode. The vessel left port on April Fool's Day, oddly enough, and docked in the Canary Islands today, and this comes to us from the widespread panic file. There's apparently widespread panic being instigated there in the Canary Islands. We don't know how well it's going for the panickers, but CNN is certainly prepared to hyperventilate if they've not started already. Now, listen to this. If that's not enough, the CNN reporter goes on to say, experts blame climate change. It's like, now, you got to wonder, how can a urinalist even use that term anymore? Experts blame climate change? Are you kidding me? Obviously, they haven't gotten the memo that, well, Gen Z isn't buying any of this stuff anymore. Nobody's buying this stuff anymore, but primarily Gen Z. I mean, Billie Eilish aside, did you happen to see the Billie Eilish video? Lamenting her high levels of...
I don't care.
Don't care about Billie Eilish? She was whining about her high levels of climate anxiety.
Yeah, she's and so rich.
I got to see... Well, that doesn't help with the anxiety, apparently. I remember, I actually complimented Billie Eilish at some point in the past for the fact that she doesn't parade around like a stripper. And that, you know,
she's
dead girl. Hey, you're stealing my lines here. I had written down here, she should be more concerned about looking like a reject from the Addams Family audition. Mm-hmm. On purpose, looking like a living dead girl. That's what she should be worried about. She looks like she's on, well, I mean, I don't want to make any accusations unfounded, but... I mean, she looks like a heroin addict, but that just may be a look for her. It's like look like a street person heroin addict when you actually make $30 million a year and live in a mansion. It's a look she's got going, but she's apparently concerned with climate anxiety, and CNN blames, well, CNN quotes experts who blame climate change. Those are the experts who haven't got the memo that nobody really cares what the experts blame anymore, because we've kind of heard all that. too many times now. So let's leave that all. Now, speaking of experts, let's go to Rudy Giuliani. We'll check in with him. And he checked out of the hospital. He checked into the hospital. This is from the Modern Miracles file, where we have a report from Newsmax that Mayor Rudy Giuliani, he's confirming that his hospitalization was related to events at Ground Zero on 9/11. How does he know that? Well, let's read on here. Giuliani, 81. Wait a minute. He's 81 and he gets checked into the hospital. Are you sure it doesn't have anything to do with the fact that he's 81 and he's already outlived the average life expectancy of the average American man? That doesn't have anything to do with it. No, it was 9/11. He reposted a post from Dr. Maria Ryan, who explained that he's suffering from restrictive airway disease after spending months at the World Trade Center site following the attacks, September 11, 2001. And she reminds us that on 9/11, Rudy Giuliani was covered with white dust, and apparently that's related to his recent hospitalization, from which he's apparently recovered, and we're thankful for that. We don't want to wish anything bad on Rudy. And we appreciate the fact that, he marched into the devastation there on 9/11. You can't deny that. So you go, Rudy. Who said this? Oh, this is Dr. Maria Ryan again. She says Giuliani's recovery is nothing short of a miracle. And then the next line in the article says Giuliani remained hospitalized for several days. And so you read that and you're like, well, it was something short of a miracle. Because, you know, with the remaining hospitalized and all. So if it was a miracle, it wasn't a really good miracle. Well, that's why this is in the Modern Miracle file. Because modern miracles are like this. You get a modern-day miracle, you stay in the hospital for a few days because you're still sick. But back in the Bible times when they were recording actual miracles, nobody stayed in the hospital. They jumped up and down and leaped and took up their bed and praised God. And well, that was back when miracles were miracles. Now they're just figures of speech or delusions. Or deceptions. I was listening to a preacher this past week, as I'm wont to do sometimes as I work in the yard. I like to listen to some good preaching. And he reported a headline, Benny Hinn removes large lump from woman's purse. I thought that was pretty funny. I mean, you know, your average joke from a hardcore King James dispensational preacher, the average jokes don't exactly split you in half, but I laughed out loud at that one. That was pretty funny. Anyway, back to Rudy Giuliani here from Newsmax. Dr. Ryan says Rudy is a deeply religious man, and she asked to keep the prayers coming. Deeply religious, not just religious, but deeply religious. I think we have some more deeply religious news coming up here. I can't remember who it was that. Let's see here. I can't remember if they call him a strong Christian or deeply religious or extraordinarily pious. I forget, but we'll get to them. There's plenty of those coming at you here. But Rudy's one of them. Deeply religious. That means when he dressed up like a woman on Saturday Night Live and embarrassed himself in front of God and everybody, that was part of his deeply religious experience. Okay. Color me skeptical about Rudy Giuliani actually comprehending the gospel and knowing God and anything about the Bible. Just color me skeptical, but I would agree that he probably is deeply religious. Which, you know what deeply religious means? That means you're religious when you need to be. when things get deep, when you're throwing out lots of deep. So, all right, we'll just move on from that. Now, yeah, when you're really worried about dying, you get deeply religious. Okay, now, speaking of deeply religious people, let's check in with the Southern Baptists. Uh-huh. As reported by the Epoch Times, here's the headline. Baptists notch attendance and baptism gains, even as membership drops. Yeah. Mm-hmm. This is from the Winham and Wedham file. That's right. You win them and you wet them. That's the formula there at the Baptist Church. I stole that from the same preacher, by the way. Win them, wet them, and work them, he said, was the formula there with the religionists in the denominational environs, such as like in a Southern Baptist church. The article from the Epoch Times goes something like this. Southern Baptists, America's largest Protestant denomination, reports that overall membership has declined for the 19th consecutive year. But in true millennial fashion, they painted a happy face on that report by noting that they're very grateful to show growth in key metrics like baptisms, which they apparently keep track of. I'm sure they log every single one. They have a count going. They say they're up. Not only are baptisms up, worship attendance is up. That means people who come to church to hear the music, that's up too. And they say Bible study participation is up. Those are the key metrics. Bible study participation. Okay. So that's people who sit at church to participate in Bible study. Instead of just studying the Bible, which is something I recommend you do at home on a daily basis and not just with all the deeply religious people on Sunday at church. But if you do participate, just know that there's someone there counting heads so that they can keep track of those key metrics. The president and CEO of the SBC Executive Committee, and so you have to stop right there. And you have to say, you know what, if our church has a president and CEO of the executive committee, I'm heading for the door. I'm sorry. I don't think I want one of those at my church. But they have one there at the Southern Baptist Convention. And he says, quote, Baptist churches are focused on sharing the gospel. Many other issues vie for our attention. But pastors seem more determined than ever to focus on our core mission, which is counting those key metrics. No, it's sharing the gospel. See, they share the gospel. They don't preach the gospel because that might be offensive or it might make someone uncomfortable to be preaching the gospel. So the deeply religious folks over there at the Southern Baptist Convention, they share the gospel, which is much nicer. So everybody remains calm when you're sharing. You start preaching. Anyway. So I just, a note to the Southern Baptists, and I know baptism is in your name and all that. Well, not, but Baptist, right? The gospel does not include baptism in water. So if you're sharing the gospel, even if you're not preaching the gospel, even if you're just sharing it, you should be aware that it does not include baptism in water. You know, a key metric I would be interested in is I would like to see a survey and I would like to read the reports written by those surveyed of how many Southern Baptist pastors can actually articulate the gospel. I'd like to see Keith Richards come up with something like that. please. All right. I don't want to. That was from last time. Go backwards on. Even coming out of a dead sleep. All right. So, from the Southern Baptist. By the way, that line about the Southern Baptist, that wasn't a punchline or a joke. It's nothing to laugh about. I mean, if your pastor can't articulate the gospel, I mean, that's more of a reason to head for the door than the whole CEO of the executive committee situation. I wonder if the CEO of the executive committee can articulate the gospel. That's probably not a requirement. He needs more certifications in accounting and counting and things like that than actually holding the mystery of the gospel in a good conscience. You know, like stuff from the Bible. But so from the Southern Baptist, we go appropriately enough to the failing religion file. You know, it's not quite the bad religion file. This is the failing religion file. We're not going to call it the bad religion file because where there's life, there's hope. And Ben Sasse is still alive. You remember Ben Sasse was a senator, and he's got cancer, and he's dying, and he could die. He could be dead at any moment. And so the WashingtonStand.com, which I was never familiar with, never heard of, never even knew existed, has a story. The headline, Five Insights from Ben Sasse's Last Days on Earth. And it's written by a urinalist named Kathy, who the folks over there at WashingtonStand.com, they list her credentials as correspondence writer at the Family Creep and Search Council. I'm sorry, the Family Research Council. I got that wrong. I'm having a hard time getting my words out to Seth. Not the Creep and Search Council, the Family Research Council, which... The WashingtonStand.com is apparently the latest imprint of the Family Creep and Search Council. And I think their official slogan over there is distracting from the gospel with politics for money. Actually their official slogan is... is a bad translation of Ephesians 6:3, and having done all, stand firm. And having done all, .. stand firm, which is just a complete misrepresentation of what Ephesians 6:13 is about. It's Ephesians 6:13 is about putting on the full armor of God in the spiritual battle that concerns the salvation or damnation of souls and the preaching of the gospel. But the folks over at the Family Creep and Search Council, they think it has to do with fighting the culture war here on earth. See, you know, the whole part about principalities and powers and our weapons are not carnal. That's, well, let me just get to the article so that you can make up your own mind. The reporter, Kathy, says, she reports that in a recent extended interview on 60 Minutes, Scott Pelley asked dying Ben Sasse, quote, if you had another 30 years, what would your priority be, unquote. Scott Pelley asked. Now, Scott Pelley, by the way, he's a staff member at 60 Minutes. And so any Christian who sits down and talks with Scott Pelley would be completely justified in assuming he's going straight to hell with jet rockets. Why? Well, he's on staff at 60 Minutes. That's a red flag. And so Ben Sasse, who's a deeply religious, strong Christian, what did he respond? He said he would spend more time with family. And then he goes on for several paragraphs with no mention of Jesus or the cross or the gospel, just talks about himself and his family. And listen, folks, I got nothing against anyone being concerned about their family. But when you're asked about dying and leaving the planet, and if you had another 30 years, what would your priority be? You would think that your priorities would be on the hereafter. I mean, you're about to die and go meet God, and you're going to be judged by him in relation to your fate forever. But Ben Sasse just goes on and on about himself and his family. Now remember the title of the article, Five Insights from Ben Sasse's Last Days on Earth. What's the number two insight from Ben Sasse as he faces imminent death and judgment? Observe the Sabbath. That's the second thing that he wishes he had started doing or did more of. I don't know. Anyway, Kathy reports, similar to fellow Christian Charlie Kirk, Sasse sees the importance of God's fourth commandment to remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. And she then goes on to talk about an interview Sasse did with Focus on the Family president Jim Daly, where he shared that his family now observes the Sabbath, and he says, quote, "Now we lock up our phones most of Sunday."
Most?
Only most of Sunday, Ben. Really? Uh-huh. So you got to wonder if Ben Sasse, being such a strong, devout, oh, that's what he is. He's not a deeply religious. That's what you call Catholics. He's a devout Christian. That's what you call someone who grew up a Lutheran and then switched over to whatever he is now. I think he's Episcopalian, I think. So they're devout. So I wonder if he's ever read James chapter 2, verse 10, Ben. Have you read this one? Listen to this, Ben. "For whoever shall keep the whole law and yet offend in one point, he is guilty of all." Ooh. He only locks up. Ben only turns his phone off for most of Sunday. Sunday's not really even the Sabbath, at least not the one, you know, in the fourth commandment. But let's leave that one aside because I'm sure Ben is far more devout than I am. But let's continue with Galatians 3:10. "For as many as are of the works of the law are under the curse." Oh, the curse? The works of the law? Like keeping the Sabbath under a curse? "For it is written," Paul says, "cursed is everyone that continueth not in all things which are written in the book of the law to do them." Ben, somebody get a recording to Ben Sasse. We have a memo for Ben Sasse. It appears, Ben, that you're going to hell by your own account of your rather sloppy Sabbath keeping. And so, yeah. Ben goes on with three more insights. Number three, help the government restrain evil and protect freedoms. Number four, community is essential. Number five, put your trust in the sovereign God, the source of peace, which are all really platitudes, just platitudes. Now, listen, during the CBS interview, Kathy reports, Scott Pelley, on staff at CNN, on his way straight to hell with jet rockets, was on the verge of tears as he talked to Ben Sasse about his experience on 9/11 at the World Trade Center when Scott Pelley thought he was about to die. Here's what Pelley said, on the brink of tears, quote, "And in that instant, the only thing that crossed my mind was leaving my family behind. And I wonder how you reconcile that." Unquote. Pelley asked Ben Sasse, "How do you reconcile that with your belief that there's a God, that I was about to die and leave my family behind?" And so Sasse is on the verge of tears as he asks Ben Sasse, devout Christian, this. Sasse responded, quote, "Yeah, I blah, 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 blah." Because it doesn't really matter what he said after that. He missed the chance to preach salvation to an open heart. If you got someone on their way to hell on the brink of tears in front of you and you know the gospel, well, that's when you lay it on them, Ben. But he didn't. He just went on and on about himself and his family. And he mentioned God, and he might have dropped a Jesus or two in there somewhere. I don't know. But he didn't preach the gospel when Pelley was open to it. Why? I can only assume it's because he doesn't know how. And I want to take some responsibility for that, because the fact that Ben Sasse is not equipped to preach the gospel is in no small part my fault. And your fault, if you want to join me in some reflection here. Someone should have gotten to this guy. One of us should have made it through to this guy and taught him how to be ready with the gospel, especially when someone's breaking out in tears in front of you. But instead, I don't know, I felt like it's like the Dilbert cartoonist. I can't remember his name. But the Dilbert cartoonist. Watching Ben Sasse die is like watching the Dilbert cartoonist die. It's like watching the slow motion train wreck of a man dying and going to hell right in front of our eyes. And at this point, there's nothing we can do. I mean, unless someone can get him a recording of this show. Anyway, it just don't let this be the case with you and the people you know. And especially your kids and people that you have a relationship with, unbelievers maybe at work or in your social circle. And especially if they're on the brink of tears, that's the time when Paul says, be instant, in season, out of season, be instant to preach the gospel. You got to always be ready. I have a very condensed, concise version of the gospel that I've memorized, that I'm always ready to lay on people. Laid it on at least four or five people in the past week alone. one of whom, her brother, had an aneurysm. He's in the hospital. She asked me to pray. And so I laid the gospel on her because, you know, for crying out loud, if you're not going to lay the gospel on them, then what's this all about? What's being devout all about? all right. And so now I have another. Let me do this first because I want to save the. This is from the Big Fraud File. A reporter, one of these new independent, uncredentialed reporters, Luke Rosiak, he posted on Twitter. Here's what he posted. You ain't seen nothing yet. He's talking about the Ohio home health fiasco. This is what he posted. You ain't seen nothing yet on the Ohio home health fiasco. And I circled the word fiasco, and I'm like, fiasco? Really? You're using the word fiasco? I mean, a fiasco is like an embarrassing failure, and we employ that word in order to make light of the failure. I mean, usually to dull the criticism, and maybe to offer each other a little bit of grace after the harsh reality of the failures is past, or to excuse responsibility at the discovery of a fiasco. The word is completely inappropriate to describe the exposure of an ongoing criminal act, Mr. Rosiak. Who's teaching these reporters how to report? I mean, I'm all for these amateur, outside, uncredentialed reporters, but man, we need some sober adults with a grip on reality who actually want to affect the world for a change to the good, not just seeking clickbait and notoriety, which, I mean, I don't know where Rosiak's coming from with that. Now, who said that a constitutional republic only lasts until voters discover they can vote themselves largesse from the public treasury? I know it's been attributed to Ben Franklin, but I did a little research, and apparently that's not it. It's often credited to Scottish historian Alexander Fraser Tytler, which you all know as Lord Woodhouse, of course. But anyway, So this whole thing about voting yourself largesse, that all came home to roost back with the Great Society like 60, 70 years ago. But neither Ben Franklin nor Lord Woodhouse could have imagined to comment on what would occur when the Congress discovered that they could loot the Treasury and launder the proceeds through a conspiracy of their constituents without any fear of punishment, and then pay off the judicial and the executive branches if anything ever came to light. That's more than a fiasco, Mr. Roziak. That's a crime. That's like the crime of the century. All right, it's the Weekly Worldview, and it doesn't matter that you can't really understand what he's saying. It was the guitar lick is what it was all about. Come on. He doesn't even know what he was talking about at the time. So, all right, so there's the, you know what's a fiasco is Roziak's reportage. That's a fiasco. We can at least kind of wink and nod at that. But now we go to, this is a sad story. This is from the Sad Religion File, as a matter of fact. And it's from jdrucker.com, which means it's written by J.D. Rucker, he's in charge of the Liberty Daily, which is an aggregator that I turn to when somebody kidnapped Matt Drudge and is obviously still holding him hostage somewhere. And J.D. Rucker reports on the death of Pastor Greg Locke's son. Greg Locke, L-O-C-K-E. I'm not going to say I was familiar with Greg Locke. I think I've heard his name here and there. I think he's a mega pastor, or I thought he was a mega pastor. And Pastor Greg Locke's son, Evan, died at the age of 20. After a fatal drug overdose this past week. And J.D. Rucker writes, quote, "This strikes at the heart of every parent who has watched his child wrestle with unseen demons." That's J.D. Rucker's take. J.D. Rucker being a devout something or other. I'm not really sure. And so Pastor Locke posted on Twitter, after his son died, which that right there strikes me as, I would never do that. If someone in my immediate family dies, the one thing I can assure all of you of is that you will not see me posting on social media about it. But Pastor Locke did, because I guess that's what people do. And I'm strange, I suppose. But here's what Pastor Locke posted. "Today words fail us. It's been a long, hard battle. In times like this, the sacrifices and the struggles don't even matter." And so I have to stop right there, okay? This fellow's son just died. And he posts about sacrifices and struggles that don't even matter. And I have to think, well, then why are you mentioning them, sir? Because whose sacrifices and struggles are you talking about? I think you're talking about your sacrifices and struggles. And I think they do matter to you. That's why you mentioned them in the first couple lines of your posts about your son dying. He goes on to talk about how his 20-year-old son, and I can't even imagine. I have a daughter right around 20. I can't even comprehend the devastation. And he posts about He says our 20-year-old son could not be revived after his heart stopped due to an overdose. And so this is just emblematic of how urinalism has infected the culture. This poor grieving dad has been trained by his consumption of modern journalism to habitually deflect responsibility. His son's heart stopped due to an overdose. It's just one degree of deflection of responsibility. Just one degree. But he's been trained to do that. And all of us who don't read modern urinalism carefully, they're training your mind, corrupting your mind, which is why I find fewer and fewer articles of much interest. It's hard to wring a whole hour show out a week because I just don't want to consume this garbage. It's not good for you. But here's the thing. You don't have to submit to the training. You can read it with a critical eye. And you should realize when you hear a fellow like Pastor Locke insert that one degree of deflection, and you should understand that unresolved sin makes such deflection a necessity. The reason modern urinalists can't assign responsibility to anyone is because they have a problem with responsibility in their own life. They have unresolved sin that leaves them feeling guilty, and the only way they know how to deal with it is to deflect. And so based on this post and what I've read so far, I would assume that John Locke, Pastor John Locke, doesn't understand the gospel. Likely very well on his way to hell right now. Now he does mention that this event is a reminder that even in our deepest pain, the grace of Jesus will sustain us. And then he goes on about how he's going to address the church and arrangements will be announced, and but he never preaches the gospel, and he's a pastor, and his son has just died. He has the example in front of him of someone who is about to meet God, someone who's meeting God right now at the judgment, and he neglects to preach the gospel. He never preached it. Well, at least not yet. Where there's life, there's hope, right? For this guy and for Ben Sasse. Someone can send him a link to this show. Where there's life, there's hope. There's still a chance you could preach the gospel. Take advantage of the situation and preach the gospel. Ben Sasse and his devoutness and Mr. Locke and his pastorship, they don't fully comprehend that one of the main reasons God instituted death was so that people who know him would have the opportunity to remind people who don't about the gospel. Because death focuses everyone on the hereafter. Even the unbeliever is focused forcefully upon the hereafter when someone dies. And so it's our responsibility to take advantage of that and use death for what God intended it for. And so I wasn't 100% familiar with who Pastor Greg Locke was. Did I call him John Locke? I apologize. I got him confused with an Enlightenment author from something running through my brain from high school. I don't know. Pastor Greg Locke, L-O-C-K-E. I apologize. I did a little research on Pastor Greg Locke because, like I say, I heard his name, but I didn't really know who he was. I thought he was a mega pastor. And here's what I found. And I checked this on a couple of sources to make sure this wasn't just a wild rumor. Apparently it's true. Evan, the 20-year-old who killed himself accidentally overdosing on drugs. Evan was the son of Pastor Locke and his former wife, Melissa. The pastor announced their separation in January 2018 in January and then married his church assistant in August when Evan was just 12 years old. And so to Mr. Rucker, who wrote the report, hidden demons? Is that what Evan was wrestling with? Unseen demons? I think not. I think what Evan Locke was wrestling with is right there in front of us. It's not an unseen demon at all. It's just the state of sinful man in the form of his own father that he was struggling with. And it's that's the sad religion file. Okay. So now where do you go from that? I'm not sure. You want to talk about the election? I'll talk about the election for a second because the primaries are happening and the maps are being ungerrymandered from where they were gerrymandered before. It's our new favorite word of the week around the McBurney compound, gerrymander, because you can apply it to almost anything and it fits. Anything that's not going well or doesn't seem quite right, obviously it's been gerrymandered. It's gotten gerrymandered, right? And so for news of gerrymandering, we go to the big rig file, where you all know the Virginia Supreme Court ruled that the redistricting referendum that was voted in by the rigged vote there in Virginia, that violated the state constitution. And so it seems to me like the courts are going to make the politicians draw the maps just by like drawing lines on a map, encompassing enough people to make a district or a precinct, or whatever, however you do it, I don't know. But it used to be you drew a line on a map in a box to encompass that many people, and that was the district. But they got to gerrymandering, which is making a district that looks like a salamander. Some guy named Jerry did it, right? It's first. Well, now they're going to make them stop with all that, or at least they say they are. And here we have a report on all of that. And it's from Newsbusters. They say the PBS NewsHour host Amna Nawaz, and just right there, I had to stop because, I mean, I remember the McNeil-Lara NewsHour on PBS, which, I mean, it was, it's always a leftist echo chamber, but, I mean, at least you could pronounce their names and they had an IQ. Now it's Amna Nawaz. Okay. She was talking with the Atlantic staff writer, David Brooks. So here you've got I don't even know who Amna Nawaz is. I didn't even know the NewsHour was still on TV. I thought PBS got canceled. I thought that was all over with. No? Anyway, but now, and of course she's talking to David Brooks, who's a mad, wild, froth-at-the-mouth leftist. And she asks him, are Republicans rigging the system? She actually used the words rigging the system. And I'm thinking, does anyone remember when no one was allowed to use the words rigged in reference to the 2020 election? Even on the conservative media, Rush Limbaugh was afraid to use the word rigged. Nobody used the word rigged. If you used the word rigged, they would tape a tinfoil hat to you and they would send you out into Conspiracyville. And you were a kook burger for assuming anything could possibly be rigged. Only conspiracy theorists use the word rigged. Now, I'm the Nawaz at the McNeil-Lehrer NewsHour is using the term. Yes, now the establishment has given us permission to use the word rigged. And I think it's to their own detriment. And I think this is a positive development. Yeah, in more ways than one. Now we can openly talk about rigging elections, which it's about time. And the establishment apparently has decided to tone things down. And that's a good thing. The term rigged, I mean, yeah, it's a charged accusation, but I mean, compared to the type of language that they've been using, I mean, this is just language that gets political corruption exposed. It's not the kind of language that gets people shot and shot at, like Nazi and fascist and white supremacist. It's nice to hear that the left is toning things down. Yeah. Anyway. So the election system is rigged, has been rigged. It's blatantly, obviously rigged to anyone who has two brain cells. And maybe now some de-rigging is happening. I certainly hope so. I have my doubts because I've been made very cynical by the modern political system and the journalism environment and all that. Here, I'll close with one piece of interesting and even good news. This was flashed in to headquarters here from our Alaska Bureau. Five publishers are suing Meta and Mark Zuckerberg personally for what they're calling massive copyright infringement perpetrated in order to train AI. That's right. This is from the Big Steel file. It's reported by Variety. I'm like, Variety? Okay, well, the lawsuit's been filed in the U.S. District Court, accuses Meta of engaging in one of the most massive infringements of copyrighted materials in history. And the lawsuit is seeking unspecified monetary damages. Meta allegedly obtained copyrighted materials through illegal torrenting from pirate sites and unauthorized web scraping. I don't like the sounds of that. That unauthorized web scraping to train the company's generative AI system. They claim Meta stripped copyright management information from the stolen works to conceal their training sources. It's as I have suspected. They've been stealing everything. And they're going to steal it, package it up, and regurgitate it to us for money. And we're going to go along with it thinking this is great, which is fairly embarrassing. Yeah, they say they have evidence that Meta briefly considered entering licensing deals with publishers, but they abruptly stopped their licensing strategy and talks in 2023, and that's about the time they started stealing everything, stuffing it in their socks and their pants as fast as they could. And so I just want to ask the reporters at Breitbart, or at Variety, I guess, because Breitbart reposted this from Variety. Isn't stealing a crime? Isn't stealing copyrighted material a crime? Why is it that the Department of Justice didn't file criminal charges before the publishers filed a civil lawsuit for monetary damages? Shouldn't somebody go to jail for all this stealing? I know Ben Sasse had quoted the fourth commandment, but I think can't remember which one it is, but I'm sure there's one that says thou shalt not steal. I'm positive of that. And that's in the criminal section of the Ten Commandments. So I'll have to go look that up. We'll do some research. We'll get the crack staff to see if maybe there's been a crime committed here. And I can't imagine why the Department of Justice hasn't filed criminal charges based on the evidence and the fairly obvious fact that everything's being stolen right in front of us in broad daylight. The only thing I can think of in my jaded, cynical mind, the only question I can ask is, could the government be in on it? Could the Donald Trump administration have judged that the return on investment is big enough that we're just going to not point out the fact that all these companies have actually stolen everything? Could it be that the deal was too good? And I don't want to offend my Donald Trump supporting listeners because I know how great he is. He's the greatest American president ever. George Washington, a pimple compared to, Dwight Eisenhower, come on. He didn't know the art of the deal. All right. Okay, so that's it for the Weekly Worldview. Thank you for tuning in. We'll be back with you next time, perhaps. And until then, may the grace of God go with you and may the peace of Jesus Christ be upon you.